This evening I'm going to talk about the question of moral relativism and talk a little bit about how our sort of the way in which we think about political disagreement is sometimes thought to be a kind of way to defend or affirm moral relativism, but I want to make a case that that's actually not the case. So before I actually get into the arguments for moral relativism, I want to make a couple of distinctions. You should all have a sheet or that has two sides to it. You know, when we talk about ethics or morality, I see this sometimes in my students at Baylor, and I've seen it throughout the years just teaching at different institutions, that sometimes people confuse moral claims with preference claims. So when I say, for example, it is wrong to torture children for fun, which is a moral claim, it's really not a response to it to say something like, yeah, but I like to torture children for fun. That is, when we make preference claims, we're simply announcing to other people what we like or dislike. But oftentimes, moral claims have a different sort of tug in our hearts in comparison to preference claims. In fact, oftentimes, if you think about it, the sort of claims of morality are sometimes contrary to our preference claims. So the two examples I have here on the notes, I like vanilla ice cream better than chocolate ice cream. It would be weird to say, no, that's wrong, right? Because preference claims simply announce to people what it is in fact something that people like. Now, people could actually like things that are bad. There's no doubt about that. But when somebody makes a claim like, for example, killing persons without justification is wrong, it actually doesn't matter whether you like it or not, right? There's something about moral claims that puts a demand on us that has nothing to do with what we like or dislike. And it's often the case that people confuse the two, especially when we debate about issues. One example, let me get from my own experience in the classroom. I think it was about 15 years ago, I was teaching a course on contemporary moral problems. I teach a course like that at Baylor every couple of years or so, but this was about 15 years ago. I had a student, we were going over the issue of abortion, and she raised her hand and she said, if you don't like abortion, then don't have one. And I raised the question to her, I said, yeah, but what if somebody actually wanted to have one and still thought it was wrong? Is that something, can you sort of conceptually comprehend that as a possibility? And she said yes. And so, and I went on to say that the reason why, think about other things. So supposing I said, supposing you saw a bumper sticker in the parking lot that said, don't like spousal abuse, don't beat one. I mean, if you saw that, you would say to yourself, that person doesn't understand what it means to say that something is wrong, right? You would say, well, actually, liking it or disliking it has no bearing on the wrongness of it. Now, concerning the debate about abortion, that's something I'll be talking about actually later on in the lecture this evening, on how that issue is, I think, ultimately a disagreement about the nature of what we think human beings really are. And so to apply that kind of reasoning to the debate is to misunderstand why people oppose abortion. They oppose abortion because they think unborn human beings are full-fledged members of the human community. They don't oppose it because they don't like it. Now, they may not like it, right? But that's not the basis for the reason why they think it's mistaken or they think that it's immoral in some way. So one of the things we have to get clear about is that when we talk about moral claims, we're making claims about what you may believe is normative, what one ought to do, but we're not making claims of what we like or don't dislike. In fact, one of the things that occurs as one matures and thinks about the moral life is this sort of internal struggle that we all face at some point in our lives between what we know that we ought to do and what we may prefer to do, right? So to confuse preference with morality is to sort of confuse, or moral claims or preference claims, it's actually to misunderstand the nature of a moral claim. So what about relativism? So I want to go over two kinds of arguments that people offer for moral relativism. Now, what is moral relativism? I have here on the sheet a definition. The belief that there exists no objective moral norms which apply to every person in every time and in every place. So, supposing, you usually hear it in when people make claims like this. It's all relative. Who am I to judge? Nobody knows. Right. I don't really get it as much today as, let's say, several years ago. Students, when confronted with, let's say, deep disagreements that people have in our culture and our society about moral questions, will say, "Well, they'll sort of throw up their hands. Who are we to judge?" Right. So usually comes out in those sorts of comments. Right. But I want to go over two kinds of arguments of why people believe in relativism, or the sorts of arguments that I've heard over the years as both a professor and somebody that has lectured at many places on the issue of relativism. So the first kind of argument, oh, by the way, I want to contrast this with the view that I think is correct, and that's the view that is typically referred to as moral objectivism. And that, as you can imagine, is just the opposite, right? It's the belief that there are sort of fundamental moral goods that are, in fact, objectively true that people can actually know. There's a kind of universality to those goods. And now, that doesn't mean, by the way, and we'll go over this later on this evening, it doesn't mean that people don't disagree on moral questions. I'm going to make the case that one can believe in moral objectivism or the fact that there are objective moral values and still acknowledge that people can disagree on particular questions. But what I want to argue that those disagreements can be accounted for outside of relativism. In other words, you don't have to be a relativist to acknowledge that there are going to be disagreements, even among reasonable people. So two different arguments I want to go over for moral relativism. The first argument is what I call the argument from disagreement. And it goes something like this. Cultures and individuals disagree about moral issues. And there's no doubt about that, right? Pick any sort of contemporary moral question, whether it's abortion, the nature of marriage, the question about whether physician-assisted suicide is permissible. People disagree, right? They disagree about all sorts of questions. So, and if you look at it cross-culturally, you look at different civilizations and different societies, there seems to be different moral rules or different ways to understand how to live the good life. In fact, even within the Catholic world, there are different ways in which Catholics think about how to conduct themselves at Mass. I don't know if you've ever, have you ever been to Italy? Anyone been to, do you ever go to communion? And everybody runs up at the same time? I just thought the Italians were being rude. And it turns out they're just being Italians. Right? So I'm half Italian, so I can say that. So you see that there are just simply cultural and social differences, right? So the argument goes like this. Cultures and individuals disagree. Therefore, no culture individual is really right or wrong. Thus, there are no objective moral norms. So we make an empirical observation. People disagree. Not only do they disagree between cultures and societies, they disagree among individuals. Therefore, there are no objective norms. The second argument I want to go over is the argument from tolerance. And the argument goes something like this. To believe that one's moral view is objectively correct and others are wrong is intolerant. We ought to not be intolerant. Therefore, we ought to be relativists. So the first argument I want to go over why I think the disagreement argument fails. So I have four objections to the disagreement argument. Well, the first is a kind of logical problem with it. The mere fact of disagreement, nothing follows about moral truth. Right? So imagine, let's use an example outside of ethics. Supposing, in constitutional law, let's say somebody thinks that, let's say the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution ought to, the Equal Protection Clause, ought to be extended to include sort of a right to physician-assisted suicide. Somebody else says, no, it's not the right way to interpret it. It doesn't follow from that there isn't a correct way to read the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Or supposing somebody says, I think the earth is flat. Somebody else says, I think it's round. Well, the mere fact of disagreement is not in and of itself enough to say, or nothing follows from that about whether there's such a thing as moral truth. And we have enough experience in our own lives that people can be mistaken about things. Well, why not about ethics? Right? I mean, supposing you're sitting, you walk into a room and there's in one seat, there's Adolf Hitler, and the other seat, there's Mother Teresa, and they're having a conversation, and you say, oh, Mother Teresa thinks one thing, Hitler thinks something else, I guess there's no moral truth. The mere fact of disagreement is not enough. And from a logical point of view, if you have the premise, individuals disagree about moral questions, and then because the hidden premise is, whenever people disagree about a question, there is no truth, therefore there is no moral truth. Well, first up, that second premise is very controversial. The mere fact of disagreement is not enough. So from a strictly logical point of view, the argument doesn't follow. A second problem with this argument is that disagreement counts against relativism. This is a little subtle of a response. So it turns out that there are people who are relativists and people who aren't relativists, right? Right? There are people that believe in objective morality and there are people that don't. Okay, so if the premise is that whenever people disagree about an issue, nobody's right, wouldn't it be a good reason to reject relativism? So the mere fact of disagreement is just not enough. A third problem with this argument gets to the question of, it sort of raises the question, why do people disagree? Okay? So people do disagree, right? They disagree about a variety of questions. But can we dig deeper and sort of ask ourselves, well, why do they disagree? I want to argue here in this third objection is that disagreement is overrated. That, yes, people do disagree, they disagree passionately, but if you look at the reasons why they disagree, it is often not the case that they disagree over sort of the moral principles or moral goods. They usually disagree about something else. And so let me give you an example that I'm actually going to come back to later on when we talk about, I'm going to talk a little bit about Aquinas and the natural law towards at the end of the lecture. But the debate about abortion. So people disagree about whether abortion is morally permissible. There are some people that identify as pro-choice. They will argue that abortion is permissible. It ought to be legal. it is currently legal. And then there are other people that argue that no, that abortion is morally impermissible. Now, there are certain variety of views, right? So some people will sometimes argue that it's impermissible after a certain point in the gestation of the unborn child. But generally, you have sort of two different camps on this, right? Now, if you read the philosophical literature on abortion, it turns out that the disagreement really is not over the moral principle. It's wrong to kill innocent persons without justification. There's no disagreement about that. The disagreement is over what is a human person, right? So you have some folks who take the argument, figures like Michael Tooley and Peter Singer and others who say that the unborn human being, the fetus, is a human being, but it's not a person. What do they mean by that? Well, they argue that in order to be to have moral status, to be a person, you have to be a being that is able to exercise certain powers. So the ability to think rationally, the ability to communicate, the ability to have a self-concept. If you don't have at least, if you don't have any of them, right? You may have one or two of them, and that may qualify you as a person. But if you have none of them, and sort of the standard fetus doesn't have any of them, therefore, even though it is a human being genetically, it's not a person. It doesn't have moral status. And so they argue, therefore, abortion is permissible. And so, but they argue that they don't disagree with the pro-lifer that it is wrong to kill innocent persons without justification. They just say, it's not a person, right? Now, there are other people, the view that I've defended in my own writings, unborn human beings are in fact persons. Why are they persons? Because it's not what they do, it's what they are, right? To make the case, I give them, you know, several different counterexamples. For example, when somebody's, let's say, temporarily comatose, or the one case that I've used in a couple of my writings. Imagine there was a mad scientist who took early embryos and obstructed their development in such a way that they would never acquire higher brain functions, so that he could sort of harvest their organs. And we think that's really, at least you should think that's really awful to do that. So imagine though a group of pro-life radicals broke into the laboratory, took the embryos, took them to another laboratory, and had scientists heal them. You would think that that a wrong had been averted. Right? If you believe that, then you have a sense that an individual human being can be wronged without actually exercising the powers of personhood. And the reason for that is that personhood is what you are, it's not what you do, right? And because our powers of personhood are along a continuum, right? You know, we all have different abilities and powers, and so if you want to ground something like human equality, you can't ground it in these powers that we have that are widely diverse, right? Some of us are smarter than others, some of us are more artistic than others, some of us have a variety of different talents that others don't, right? And yet we believe that human beings are equal, right? How do you ground that? And so that's my view. But the point is, in terms of relativism, it turns out that the person, the individual, the philosopher that wants to justify abortion agrees with the pro-lifer that it is wrong to kill persons without justification. He accepts that principle, but in order to justify abortion, he has to argue that the fetus is not really a person, right? So the disagreement isn't over this deep moral principle, it's over what philosophers call a metaphysical issue. You know, what is the nature of this being? And this is why whenever you encounter people that try to rationalize bad behavior, that actually in a way speaks to the truth of moral objectivism, right? That is, they understand, oh, what I'm doing is ordinarily wrong, but I have to justify it, right? So there's, I don't know if any of you have seen the movie The Mission. It's kind of dated now. It came out in the late 1980s with Robert De Niro. And it involves an individual. It's been years since I've seen it, so I don't entirely remember every aspect of the film, but there was a scene in the film that really stood out to me, and I think really speaks to this question of moral objectivism. There's a scene where the De Niro character, who had worked and been kind of a mercenary for the Portuguese in South America, and then wound up becoming a Jesuit priest and becoming an ally to the indigenous people of South America, and he was there to make sure that they weren't exploited by the Portuguese colonizers. And there's a scene where there's two Portuguese, I think, admirals, and they're arguing about whether it's permissible to enslave the indigenous people of South America. And one of them says they're made in the image of God, and the other one says, no, they're not. They're not human. And what that speaks to is that they both understood the moral principle, right? And the other one wanted to justify the injustice, right? So, and even in cases where people may be totally sincere in their way of evaluating a moral issue, it often comes down to those aspects of the question that seem to be most meaningful to them. But the moral principle remains the same. Okay. So think about even an issue like physician-assisted suicide. How do people justify that? Right? They appeal to easing the suffering of the person at the end of life, right? So they have to bring into play another good in order to justify the action of intentionally killing a human being, right? Or acting in a way that they know that intends the death of another human being, right? So think about the way we respond to, let's say you hear of, let's say, somebody committing suicide. Supposing you hear, Jones committed suicide. What's the first question you ask yourself? Why? Right? But if somebody said, I saw Jones walking across campus, you don't ask why. You don't say, why is he alive? You automatically think that is the way in which those human beings are ordered towards that good, and you don't ask for a justification for why someone's alive. They don't. On the other hand, if somebody's life is taken or they perish in some way, you ask for some sort of justification, right? And it's because we automatically have within us a kind of understanding that we're ordered towards the good of life. So, third objection is that disagreement is overrated. One other illustration that I use in the notes is, if you go to certain parts of the world, people do not eat cattle, right? Well, why don't they, right? One is that the belief in what is sometimes called transmigration, that certain creatures in the natural world have been reincarnated with human souls, but these souls are in creatures that are not human, right? And so the same reason why we don't eat corpses is the same reason why they don't eat cattle. Because of the belief that those creatures once had the equivalent of human souls in some way. All right, so the fourth objection, there are counterintuitive consequences to relativism. So what are counterintuitive consequences? It's those things that strike you as just wrong. Right? So supposing you're at a marriage encounter weekend. I went to one 31 years ago with my wife about a year after we were married, and it was during football season, and I had to write down my feelings in a blue book. And of course, in those days, there was no social media. I couldn't check on the games. But I grew closer to her, and so I'm delighted that I went. So imagine you're at a marriage encounter event, and one of the speakers says, walks to the podium and says, I want to talk about what, the obligations that husbands and wives have for each other. And one of the speakers says, a good wife washes her husband's socks by hand. Now, the right way to respond to that is to say, well, wait a second. My wife is good and she doesn't do that, so that standard is wrong. Right? In other words, you allow what you already know to be true as a defeater to some kind of standard that somebody brings up. So somebody says, well, everything's relative, right? There is no objective morality. Well, what sort of things result from that? Well, you can think, well, that means that on what grounds could we say that the Nazis were wrong, right? The claim that it's wrong to torture children for fun everywhere, in every place, and every time seems to be, I'm more certain about that than I am about whether Einstein's theory of relativity is true. In fact, if you think about it, most of our sort of fundamental moral beliefs, we're actually more confident about those than we are about things in, let's say, the hard sciences. It's supposed to be a paradigm of knowledge, right? The hard sciences are the best way of knowing things. And yet, if somebody were to tell you, the scientist at, we'll say, ASU, at Arizona State, says that, that there's a reason why they're called the Sun Devils. So imagine there's a professor at ASU who says, I'm a chemist, and I did this experiment, and I proved with, in the laboratory that it's right to torture children for fun. You would be immediately skeptical of that, right? And you should be, right? And the reason is that in some ways your moral beliefs are actually more sturdy than these other things that we believe, that we think, or we're told are the sort of the paradigm of knowledge. Right, so the fourth objection is that this argument is counterintuitive. So some of the other examples that I put: Mother Teresa was no better than Adolf Hitler. Rape is not wrong everywhere, and killing people without justification is sometimes right. Okay. So one of the consequences of moral relativism is that you have to sort of accept these counterintuitive beliefs, and I'd rather not be a relativist. Right. So let me go over the second argument for relativism. The second argument is the argument from tolerance. And that argument goes like this. Since moral objectivism, believing that one's moral perspective is right while others is wrong, is an intolerant view. And since we ought to avoid being intolerant, therefore moral relativism is the correct view. Right. So, this happened a couple of years ago. I published a book with Cambridge University Press, and I published two with them, but 2007 I published a book called Defending Life, and it was a book on the presentation defending the pro-life view on abortion. And I got invited to be on several radio shows to talk about the book, and on one radio show, I didn't know they were going to do this, but they had somebody in the studio that was going to take the opposite position. So it was kind of set up, and which was fine. It was some college radio station somewhere, and so the person that was in the studio, I was at home in my pajamas, and so the person on the other end said, the problem with you, your view, is you think you're only right and everyone's wrong. And the implication being that that's an intolerant position. So I said, well, do you think I'm wrong in thinking this way? And the person in the studio said, yes. I said, well, you're just like me then. You think you're right and I'm wrong. And so the idea that somehow believing that you're right is itself mistaken, it's kind of an odd thing to say, right? Because no matter what belief somebody holds on any issue or any question, by its very nature, it's going to exclude, right? So if you believe that, supposing you believe Catholicism is true, well, the implication is that other religious beliefs, although they may have truths in them, are mistaken in profound ways, right? On the other hand, supposing you believe that all religions are in some way correct, right? Or that they all lead to God. Well, that means that you think that the person who thinks that's false is wrong, right? So there's sort of no escaping, you know, at some point, no matter what beliefs you hold, are going to be exclusive. That's just the very nature of rational thought. I mean, the only way to get out of it is to simply abandon rational thought, you know, and that's not, I don't think, a good option. So two other objections to this argument. The first is that tolerance presupposes objective morality. What I want to argue here is that the idea that you can defend relativism by appealing to tolerance is self-defeating. So if you think about it, if everyone ought to be tolerant, then tolerance is an objective moral norm, right? And thus, moral relativism is false. Also, tolerance presupposes that there's something good about being tolerant, such as being able to learn from others with whom one disagrees or to impart knowledge and wisdom to other people. But that presupposes, again, objective moral values. So why would you want to be tolerant of other people, right, and their views? Well, there's a variety of one could be you think that it is a social good that people get along with others in their community, right? There's that seems to be an objective moral value, right? To be neighborly, right? To get along with others with whom one may disagree. Another is that I can learn something, right, from people with whom I disagree. I can either change my mind, right, or I could maybe become more confident in my view, right? I talk to people and go, well, I guess I understand what they're saying, but I still disagree, and I am more confident that I'm right. Or you could be corrected, right, which is the next objection, right? The tolerance presupposes that someone may be correct, right? You can't be tolerant of views that you agree with. You're only tolerant of views you disagree with, right? It wouldn't make any sense, right? To say that, you know, that somehow, to say something like, I think you're wrong. Well, that's intolerant. That doesn't make any sense, right? I can only, so, the only way that I can, that tolerance makes sense as a virtue, I think, is that the other person disagrees with you, you think they're mistaken, but you feel you're obligated to listen to them and treat them with respect and dignity, right? So tolerance as a virtue actually presupposes, in some ways, objective morality, right? Whether it's the sort of goods that we acquire by being tolerant, you know, being able to understand others, but also the possibility that we can actually learn from others with whom we disagree, right? We could change our minds, right? And we may, for that reason, draw closer to the truth as a consequence. I want to just go over two other problems with moral relativism. So those are the two arguments, the argument from disagreement and the argument of tolerance. But there are two additional problems with relativism that many people have brought up over the years. And one is, you can't have moral progress with relativism. That is, we'd like to believe that cultures and individuals and civilizations can actually get better, right? So we think about in American history, there are many things that have occurred in the past. We think, you know, we were mistaken on certain matters, right? And we're better for that, right? Maybe on others, we're actually not as good, right? So these kind of judgments, though, about progress and about getting better and improvement presupposes what? There's a good or end to which we are moving, right? But you can't have a good to which you're moving unless there's really a good, right? You can't say, you know, so-and-so is better or more virtuous than he was last week or last year or a decade ago, right? That only makes sense if in fact, there's such a thing as an objective good, right? Because if relativism is the case, the best you can do is say, well, so-and-so changed, right? And if you think about it, you know, a lot of the criticisms that have been leveled against religious belief presuppose moral objectivism. So I'm thinking here of very popular books that came out about over a decade ago by folks like Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, Daniel Dennett. I think at least Hitchens and Dawkins focused on this as the injustices and atrocities committed by people in the name of God. Now, if you're a relativist, it's difficult to figure out why those are wrong, right? I mean, if you believe that morality is simply reducible to sort of cultural, different cultures and individuals, why not just say, okay, back then they thought that was right, but we're different, right? To sort of condemn these atrocities means what? There has to be a kind of objective set of values that apply to all persons in all times and all places, and those individuals and those groups in the past that engaged in atrocities in the name of God were objectively wrong. And so to say that actually requires that one abandon relativism. So a second problem, another problem with relativism, and it's very similar to the no moral progress problem, and that's the reformer fallacy. So the reformer fallacy is that if morality is reducible to culture and society, then a society really can't have moral reformers. Right, because the moral reformer goes against what the society generally is practicing or teaching, right? You think of someone like a Martin Luther King Jr., right, or individuals during in the 19th century, the abolitionists, or even in early church history, the Christians that opposed infanticide, right, in the Roman Empire. If you're a relativist, you're a cultural relativist, you have to say, well, those people were wrong in opposing their culture, right? Because morality is reducible to culture. But the only way that moral reformers make sense is if there is an objective morality and that they actually had insights that their own culture either ignored or played down or in some way distorted, right? And so the other problem is the moral reformer fallacy. All right, so I want to conclude with just a couple of comments. And I here want to bring in Thomas Aquinas. This is, after all, the Thomistic Institute. And I want to say a few things about Aquinas and natural law and how that ties into politics. And we don't have that much time. I think we have about five more minutes left. So this is going to be very brief, and then I'll open the floor for a few minutes of questions. What is the natural law? So much of what I've been saying here, even though I've not used the phrase natural law, much of my argument sort of presupposes there's such a thing as the natural law, especially the appeal to intuitions, right? And to the appeal to the fact that people, even though they may on one level disagree, if you sort of dig deeper, there's actually a lot more in common even between views that we think are polarized. So what Aquinas says in the Summa Theologica is that there are goods to which human beings are ordered for which law and political institutions exist. So let me just briefly mention some of them. So Aquinas argues that we are rational creatures with natural inclinations to pursue what we believe is good, preserve our lives, beget and educate children, know truths about the world and the divine, and live in a community at peace with others. That's sort of my summary of, real quick summary of what Aquinas says in the section of the Summa called the Treatise on Law. There's a section on the natural law within that. And so what he's doing there, though, he's not giving an argument to sort of answer relativism. What he's really doing is saying there just seems to be goods to which human beings are ordered. And by the way, when he says what to goods to which people are ordered, he means that we are, that there's a kind of teleology or design of human nature. And it comes out in different ways. So I had a student when I used to teach at UNLV. I taught at UNLV for 7 years between 1989 and 96. And one of my students in a class on moral philosophy, we were going over moral relativism, she raised her hand, she goes, "Why is the truth important?" And I answered, "Do you want the true answer or the false one?" And that was a moment where, I mean, that's what Aquinas is saying, is that our minds are ordered towards knowing. And to sort of be purposely ignorant or to intentionally deny yourself a truth for your own good is actually immoral, right? Now, we all kind of presuppose that. And so what Aquinas is doing in the Summa is, again, he's not kind of giving an argument to sort of prove relativism wrong, because that's not even on the table. In the Middle Ages. What he's trying to do, he's trying to give an account of why all these human civilizations that he knew about kind of have similar understandings about the human good, despite the fact that there are deep differences. And so one of the things that the natural law tradition teaches is that there are a variety of reasons why people could get certain moral truths wrong, but they can't get them entirely wrong. So think about, again, going back to the issue of abortion. So the moral principle of what, or what Aquinas would say, one of the precepts of the natural law, and what he means by that is that there are these sort of these general kind of ideas about the natural law, but as we use our reason, we begin to think about how they actually get cashed out in particular cases. So one of them is this one. It is morally wrong to kill another person without justification. It turns out all societies prohibit homicide. Right? So it's almost a universal truth. But all those societies, in one way or another, carve out exemptions. But they only do so by justifying them. Right? So supposing you believe in a just war, right? You believe that it's permissible to kill in war. You give a reason for it, or you try to justify it. Why? Because you already assume that life is a fundamental good to which we're ordered, and to intentionally end a life, a human life, is kind of prima facie, that is to say, on the face of it, wrong. So if we're going to do it, we have to come up with a reason why it's permissible. Right? And so different societies will, in fact, come up with slightly different ways of understanding this. Another thing that it turns out, that something like theft, right? So I have students at Baylor who have plagiarized. It's shocking, isn't it? In fact, I had one student who plagiarized was so bad, not even his sin was original. I've been waiting to use that joke for a while. So why do people do things like that? Do they believe that theft is right? No. There's all sorts of things that occur when a human being engages in an action, right? You could be moved by passions, right? So the student says, "I know it's wrong, but I don't like this class. I don't like this class, and I've got other things I'm more interested in. And so they're sort of drawn. So they commit the wrong, right? Or somebody could be, like, say, formed or educated in, let's say, in a community where nobody ever told them that plagiarism is wrong, right? And so those, so what the natural law does, it tries to account for why there are these sort of exceptional cases, right? But down deep, all those exceptional cases speak to the truth of the natural law. So if I don't know how many of you have ever read C.S. Lewis's book, The Abolition of Man. It's a wonderful book, and one of the things he points out, he doesn't use the term natural law, but one of the things he points out is that whenever somebody violates the natural law, and here he actually, in Abolition of Man, he's talking about what's going on in Europe in the early 1940s, namely the Second World War. He's actually giving these lectures, I think, at the University of Durham, right in the middle of the war, while London is being bombed. And so he doesn't mention Hitler by name, but he says in the book that even people that say it is that one should honor and be loyal to the fatherland, that's based on a legitimate inclination that we have, namely to love our country. It's a type of piety, right? But taken to the extreme, you get this sort of radical nationalism and fascism in Europe. The point that Lewis makes is that even when there are these extreme cases of injustices, you can never quite escape the natural law. It has to be employed in one way or another to attempt to justify the atrocities. So that's the natural law. So let me open up the floor for any questions you may have. I noticed that it is, I've gone a little bit longer than I supposed, but I thought I was going to, but let me open the floor for any questions you may have.
I wonder if I'm trying to push a bit of a, I guess maybe a theoretical relativism to natural law. I don't know how far it would go. But like, I guess supposing that if like the natural law is based in the way we are designed in our human nature, could we argue that if we were of a different nature, there would be a different law that applies to us?
Yeah, it would. It would. Yeah. So, So let's supposing when human beings are killed, let's say they die, let's say somebody killed, and they like immediately like are, you know, like let's say you cut yourself and you heal up at the same sort of thing, right? Probably murder wouldn't seem that bad, right? Or we would think that, you know, if God made us that way, right? Or let's say there wasn't scarcity in resources. In fact, even Aquinas talks about this. He says that, the idea of private property is really the result of human beings after the fall. That is sort of, in the sort of perfect society, we would share everything in common and there wouldn't be private property. But it is something that we have to have given, you know, the fact that we're finite and that, you know, we have limited resources and so forth. So, if things were different, I think that would be the case, yeah. Yes, this gentleman.
So, we are the genocidal animal.
I'm sorry?
We are the genocidal animal.
Yeah.
Okay, every religion says, thou shalt not kill. And that if you're, everybody that's alive in this room is here because somebody has committed genocide in the past. The history of the world is written in genocide. So how do we come to say that we are just generally, us human beings, are moral relativists?
Yeah.
Because we behave that way from time immemorial.
See, I would say that your observation actually proves the opposite. It's something that Lewis said, C.S. Lewis says in The Mere Christianity. He says, this is the oddity about human beings and morality. We know the moral law, and we know we haven't lived up to it at the same time. So what you're saying is a kind of more universal observation, right? We know it's wrong, and yet
we justify it every day.
Yeah. So, I mean, because the thing is, and this is where I think Aquinas is really helpful. You know, one of the things that I like about the way St. Thomas presents the natural law is it's this really kind of deeply realistic understanding of human nature, that human beings kind of know these things, but we also have something else that's part of us, the passions, the concupiscible and irascible passions, right? And so there's more to morality than just the moral law. There's also the virtues, because he understands that in order to practice the moral law, you have to master those passions, right? And so that's something I think a lot of, in my own profession, philosophy, a lot of philosophers who write on moral issues kind of ignore the role that our kind of sub-rational nature plays in the way we kind of try to justify things.
So, I mean, I don't know about your reading of Thomas, but my reading of Thomas about war is very simple.
Yeah.
I mean, he never says that you can't justify war. But if you read his justifications, you come to the conclusion that virtually every war you know about is not justified.
Yeah.
From a moral perspective that Thomas gives.
Yeah, I don't know about that, but yeah.
That's my interpretation.
So I mean, that's one part of Aquinas I've not read a lot of. What we call the doctrine of double effect actually comes from his, which is often used to defend war. So I'm not going to debate you on it. So yes.
I was curious about your take on thinkers like Campagna, who say on abortion that we can understand that science tells us that life begins at conception, and to kill an innocent life, even the fetus, is murder, but that the social contract, certainly in the West, means that individual liberties extend to women having full bodily autonomy, and so expelling anything within their physical sphere should be within their
rights. So so I don't know if this is the argument you're referring to. There's a famous argument in philosophy offered by Judith Jarvis Thompson. It's the argument from, she basically concedes for the sake of argument that the fetus is a person, and she says, even if it is a person, abortion is still justified. I don't know if this is...
Right.
Yeah.
Because it's in the physical sphere of the woman.
And so she argues, she uses analogies. She says, imagine you are, you're invited to a society of music lovers party, and you didn't know this, but you were only invited because it turns out that that a group of physicians surveyed all the individuals in the community, and it turns out you have the right blood type to be hooked up to this world-class violinist who just needs to use your kidneys for 9 months. And so she says, if they knock you out, you wake up, you're attached to the violinist, do you have a right to unplug yourself? And she says, yes, of course. So, well, the violinist is a person, right? So why wouldn't that be, so abortion is permissible. My response, and I have several responses. One is, one response, which actually is not published on this, I've been thinking about this lately, that I don't think we need an analogy to understand pregnancy. In other words, why can't one say, pregnancy is sui generis. It's the way in which human beings come into being, and to say that somehow that is a supererogatory act just seems really strange, right? It is just like other things that human beings do. Okay, I've never written on that. That's just sort of something I've been thinking about. But another response is that there's a difference between unplugging the violinist and intentionally performing an abortion that actually doesn't just unplug the fetus, it actually destroys it, right? I mean, I don't want to get into graphic details about the types of abortions. The other is, if, let's say, you find yourself in a position in which you acted in a way that brought a vulnerable person to existence, I mean, it seems to me that there is a kind of obligation that one has. So, supposing there was a machine here, and every time I touched it, let's say, it gave me a kind of euphoric feeling, but I knew that there was 1 out of 20 chance that a vulnerable human being would come into existence, right? You would think that if I said, well, I'm not responsible for that being, that seems kind of odd. Now, getting back to the bodily question, though, in this case, there's no bodily connection. But supposing that we think about, let's say, the deadbeat dad, right? Supposing there's a couple, husband and wife, or let's say an unmarried couple, they engage in intimate relations, the woman gets pregnant. Let's say they used all forms of birth control, but she got pregnant anyways, and she says, I've decided to have the child. And he says, well, I didn't intend for that child to come into being. And then she has the child, she goes to family court, and she demands that he pay child support. Under Thompson's view, it would be immoral for the court to require that he, that 20% of his salary over 18 years are used to take care of the child. And supposing he's a laborer, supposing he's a mechanic, right? So technically the court would be requiring that he use 20% of his bodily labor for 18 years to take care of a child. And yet we don't think that's unjust. So that's a, all right, any other, yeah.
Do you think that moral relativism has become less popular over the last, 15 years?
I think it has. I mean, I think there's this kind of, I don't know how to put it, that I think people are relativists in the sense that they believe the sort of these overarching kind of social justice views that everyone should accept, but at sort of questions of sort of personal morality, there's relativism, which is kind of just old-fashioned liberalism. Right, which is what, because I don't think liberalism is a relativist view, right? You have to sort of believe in fundamental rights and so forth. So I think that, and I also think that the term morality is often used to mean something like kind of morality concerning intimate human relations, but questions of justice are not thought of as moral. And I don't know how, I mean, this is sort of my theory of how people kind of compartmentalize this, because in class, when I bring up these counterexamples, students immediately abandon relativism. They go, well, I don't believe in that, right? Because I do think that there's something like that going on. And in a sense, you could, and it's a view I hold, I think that, and this view Aquinas held as well, it doesn't follow from the fact that there's an objective morality, that every activity that is immoral should be proscribed by the law, right? I mean, there, for a variety of reasons, one of which is that could actually result in worse things for society, right? You could have, a kind of police state and so forth. So, yeah, Father.
I mean, following up on that, it seems like a good approach, because there are some areas that people are morally relative, but show where people are at some issues of justice where you can see some objective truth. Get people to see that first and then move into some other areas might be a good approach.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. In the area of religious liberty, generally, I don't know, I think it's because we've had a really long experience, at least in the United States with this, we have no problem thinking, yeah, there could be a religious truth, but I think it's perfectly permissible for the government to allow people religious freedom. But we don't think that necessarily means religious relativism, right? But for some reason, it's not caught on in other questions. So.